From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, classroom Ten Commandments lose in federal court.
Putting religious doctrine out as a thing that is meant to be seen doesn't really reflect what the separation of church and state, from my understanding, should be.
And how Republican redistricting is playing out in Texas politics.
Support for this podcast of Texas Matters comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. By investing in local communities and rewarding policyholders for prioritizing safety, they are building a more resilient Texas. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A federal judge in San Antonio has temporarily blocked a new state law requiring public schools to post the Ten Commandments in every classroom. In a 55-page ruling, Judge Fred Berry found the law likely violates the First Amendment by favoring a specific religious tradition and possibly coercing students into observance. The lawsuit, Rabbi Nathan v. Alamo Heights ISD, was led by Rabbi Mara Nathan, who challenged the law on behalf of her family, arguing that religious education belongs in the home and faith community, not mandated by the state. I spoke with Rabbi Nathan about the ruling.
I'm thrilled and just very hopeful that this will hold so that my child will be protected from having any sort of religious doctrine, particularly the Ten Commandments, shown in their school as a regular thing.
Talk about why you decided to join this case as a plaintiff and what that's been like.
You know, this is not the first moment where I have felt like our Texas government has overreached in terms of how they have tried to dictate what life should be like for citizens. And when I heard about this law particularly hitting our schools, it made me very concerned. My child is one of just a handful of Jewish children in their grade. And so they already feel like a minority, particularly when it comes to holiday seasons and whatnot. It already feels like they're one of just a few who's left to explain their own faith traditions and to explain why they don't follow Christian traditions. And so this law to put up the Ten Commandments that are particularly Christian in their rendering felt like just one more thing that was going to make them feel like they didn't belong. So the opportunity to speak out and stand up and also use my platform as a religious leader in our community felt like an opportunity to do something that was important. So I was delighted to have the opportunity to do it. And then to also be able to be the lead plaintiff on the case.
So, Rabbi Nathan, what about people who say this is not a Christian rendering, that this is something that all faiths follow?
I don't have a problem with the underlying tenets that perhaps are universal, though perhaps not. But the way that they are presented in these particular Ten Commandments has no context. So there's no Jewish context. Jewish tradition, certainly the Ten Commandments are part of our tradition. They're an important part of tradition, but they are only part of our legal tradition. And to not recognize that they're given as part of a specific covenant between God and the Jewish people and having them just stand on their own makes them not Jewish. So it doesn't feel... So there's that. And then there's also the fact that putting religious doctrine out as a thing that is meant to be seen doesn't really reflect what the separation of church and state, from my understanding, should be. And we choose to send our child to a secular school, a public school. So we'd like that space to stay secular. It doesn't mean children can't learn about other people's cultures. Of course, they should. I love that my child has friends of all different faiths and different cultural backgrounds, but that is not, learning about different faiths and cultures is not the same thing as posting a particular faith perspective, because there's an underlying assumption, if that's posted on the walls, that that is the accepted and appropriate way of looking at the world.
According to this new law, this begins September 1st, it's now on hold in those school districts in part of this case, but they would have had a really large poster in the classroom from the first day of kindergarten all the way to the last day, senior in high school, that they would have this poster of the Ten Commandments in their classrooms. And then the people who defend this law saying this is not indoctrination, that this is a benign poster. It doesn't do anything. It poses no harm to the students.
Of course, I don't know their personal perspective, but I know that my child, when they walk into school, they understand that they are a minority. And when even a passive, so-called passive thing like a poster on a wall is there day in and day out, I think the message is clear that the goal is for all the students to identify with a certain Christian understanding of the world. And, I have plenty of Christian friends who are also opposed to having the Ten Commandments up on the wall, because regardless of their personal faith, they feel like faith is, and I agree with them, is a personal choice, and how we raise our own children and teach our own children is our choice. So for the school to take it upon itself, or in this case, the state to take it upon itself to determine what our children should see, and for me to determine what my child should see every single day, I find it to be incredibly uncomfortable and an invasive law.
Do you find it a little bit ironic that these same people who want to put the Ten Commandments in these classrooms, saying it is just a passive display and it is not indoctrinating students, are the same people who wanted to take down posters that say all students are welcome, and also any kind of rainbow display in a classroom? These were considered to be inflammatory and needed to be removed.
I find it hypocritical, but I don't necessarily find it ironic. I think this is why I don't think it is passive. I think they know what they're doing. I think those beliefs, again, are that there's one specific way to live in the world. And if you don't ascribe to that, then you're not welcome here. And so classrooms that have signs that emphasize that all human beings are worthy of love and compassion and equality, I support that. But those ideas, like, you can find them in religious texts, but they don't have to come from religious texts. There are plenty of wonderfully and important ethical teachings that many, many faith traditions subscribe to and non-religious people subscribe to that can be posted and shared and taught that get the same ideas across without putting them into an explicitly religious context.
So if a parent wants their child exposed to the Ten Commandments with a giant poster day after day, they could put that up in their homes.
And or they could send their child to a parochial school.
And get money for it. Under the Texas voucher system. There was the argument that having the Ten Commandments in these classrooms violates the rights of parents who want to be able to instruct their own children in their own way about their family's religious beliefs. Do you see that?
I do. Not only for people who are actively involved in their own faith communities, but for people who choose not to be involved in any faith community at all. Whether or not the Ten Commandments are part of my faith tradition, which they are, though not how they were listed in the law, I know many people who don't raise their children with a particular faith tradition. And so, again, having something like the Ten Commandments on the wall in every classroom sends a message to those children that their parents perhaps are not making the right choice, that the school has no right to do that. The state has no right to do that. We're entitled to raise our children as we see fit in a religious context or not. Obviously, as a rabbi who's dedicated her whole adult life to not only living a Jewish life, but creating space for other people to live Jewish lives, faith is very important to me and Jewish traditions and teachings are very important to me and I hope are very important to the members of my own community and the Jewish community at large. But again, that's their choice to be part of that community. I don't feel like any sort of public displays, especially in a classroom where our students are there, as you said, day in and day out, there's really no way to avoid those postings. It really takes away the rights of parents to determine the kinds of lessons and the way that those lessons are imparted that their children are going to learn.
Attorney General Ken Paxton has already announced he is appealing this. So this will be working its way up through the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. But this isn't the first time that this case has gone to the courts and the case has lost and is even lost on appeal. This is, has already been established in the law that you're not supposed to be able to do that. What's your thoughts on why this is happening, even though previous attempts to post the Ten Commandments have failed in this way under the law, and here we are again?
Right. Well, of course, I can't pretend to know what is going on in Ken Paxton's mind, but I do think that there is a bit of a national surge of Christian teaching and Christian authority really coming to the fore and riding on that wave of emphasizing those practices and ideals as the practices and ideals. I believe that our state government is once again trying to create a environment where Texas is a Christian state. Our own Texas Constitution prohibits that. And so I do find it peculiar that our own elected officials would, in addition to the Constitution, but go after the state, their own state constitution and violate the tenets that are part of that. But Texas is a place that has always been proud of letting people make their own free choices. And I think it's important that we continue to honor those traditions. That means whether or not you and I look at the world the same way or believe the same things about God or faith, we should each be respected and be protected and given our own space to live our lives accordingly.
The First Amendment's pretty clear. It was quoted in the judge's write-up that this is a violation of the First Amendment. The founders were clear according to that. What are your thoughts? This is what America is supposed to be, and now retconning of what our rights are seems to be part of an agenda.
I agree with you. And so our choices are to say nothing and let it go on, or to stand up and speak out and do what we can as best we can to remind our country of the importance of our Constitution and the First Amendment, and to make sure as many people as possible understand what's at stake and let them speak out as well. So whatever happens, I'm in. I'm in for the long haul. I feel really passionately about this issue, and I feel honored to be able to be part of this process to speak up about something I believe really strongly in.
Rabbi Mara S. Nathan has served as the senior rabbi at Temple Beth-El in San Antonio since 2014. She is the first woman to lead a major congregation in the state of Texas. Republican state leaders are not able to move forward with approving a controversial mid-decade redistricting map backed by President Trump and Governor Greg Abbott. The plan would add up to 5 new Republican-leading congressional districts ahead of the 26 midterms, potentially reshaping the state's political map and keeping Congress under Republican control. Democrats and voting rights experts call this map a partisan power grab and a racial gerrymander designed to dilute minority voting power. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report.
The Democrats are defeated, and that's not unusual. They were steamrolled at the Capitol. The minority party loses these votes when it's partisan stuff. But I was thinking a lot about the debate that played out on the floor of the Texas House earlier this week. And it was as nasty as I have seen it. And in the past, we have had members of the legislature nearly getting into fist fights. We've had members of the legislature cussing each other out on the floor. But this was essentially the entire Republican caucus spiking the football and mocking the Democrats as they were losing. And I think a big difference here is that the Republican Party in the era of Trump has become what I would call sore winners. Not sore losers, sore winners. You know, they're mad and angry even when they're winning. And that's a huge difference from more than 20 years ago. You go back to 2003 and the last time there was a mid-decade redistricting like this. At that time, what was similar was you had forces from Washington. You had the House Majority Leader, Tom DeLay, who was from Sugar Land, Texas at the time. You know, he was basically giving the orders to the legislators at the Texas Capitol. They were, you know, executing this on behalf of President Bush at the time to, you know, secure more Republican seats in Congress for him in Washington. But those members on the floor of the House, the Republican members at that time in 03, David, they could remember what it was like to be in the minority, because remember, they only won the majority in the House the year before that in 2002. And so they could remember what it was like to be on the losing end of these votes. And they certainly were not mocking the Democrats, hating the Democrats as they were going through, you know, the motions of doing what they needed to do at that time, you know, for their party nationally. But this time around, it is very different. You know, as Democrats were making their arguments on the floor of the House, it was extremely tense, about as tense as I've seen it. When Nicole Collier, who got a lot of national attention this week, when she did basically a sit-in on the floor of the Texas House because she refused to have a police escort, you know, 24/7 in Austin after coming back from that quorum break in Chicago, Nicole Collier was asking Republican Chairman Todd Hunter about the quorum break and about this idea that Democrats fled the state. She asked him, get this, she asked him, did you know that in the times of slavery, the black people fled their oppressors and the Jews fled the Nazis in Germany? And you could have, I mean, people in the crowd, you know, it was, you could have heard a pin drop when she asked it. The people who were there started to applaud. The Speaker of the House didn't really allow for an answer on that question. Instead, he said that he would have the state troopers clear out the gallery. The audience would have to leave if they kept, you know, reacting to what was happening on the floor. And as Democrats were objecting to certain things that were happening procedurally yesterday or earlier in the week, David, the fact is that there were Republican members who were openly mocking the Democrats. When Democrats would say, we object, the Republicans would say things like, well, duly noted, ha ha, they would laugh at them. I've just never seen that kind of disrespect on the floor of the House. And I've got a lot of longtime observers of the legislative process saying that it's never going to be the same after that. I would say, to temper that a little bit, that redistricting is always bitterly partisan. But again, now we're living in the era of the sore winners.
To say that the Democrats are defeated, they lost the vote and the maps are passed, but you have to wonder, the fact that they did do the quorum break, they ran and we created a national story, they highlighted what is happening in Texas with these maps. I don't think that story would have had the legs and the spotlight had they not done that. And it also created the fervor in California for them, for the Democrats to do their own redistricting and create five seats for the Democrats and balance out Texas. That's yet to be decided. But still, I mean, you can lose and still win. I mean, they lost at the Alamo, but they won at San Jacinto. So, you know, how do you look at that?
Interesting you bring that up. We're on the air in San Antonio, right? And earlier this month, I had asked the U.S. House Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, when he came to the Capitol in Austin, I asked him this. I said, you know, Democrats in this state, in legislative fights and in elections, they do feel like the defenders at the Alamo, that they're trying their best. They're fighting as hard as they can. They're tired and help is not coming. What is the National Party going to do? And what you saw after that was Jeffries and the others in the National Party, including the Democratic National Committee Chairman Ken Martin. They really backed up and supported the Texas House Democrats as they fled the state for 2 weeks. And you did see monetary resources flowing in for them to be able to keep that story going, as you mentioned. And this is the first time in my coverage of the legislature that I've seen a quorum break lead to national action and not just a national story. You remember in 2021, when the Democrats fled the state and went to Washington, D.C., they were almost begging Congress at that time to enact voter protections of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, right? You remember that. Mm-hmm. And of course, Congress didn't do anything. As one Democratic operative said to me, they said, you know, Scott, a lot of presidents can't get Congress to act. And so the legislators from Texas were not going to be able to do that. It's at the state legislative level that a lot of the action actually happens. And if you look at what's going on around the country, it's not just California, which you mentioned, of course, that they're already taking action right now to try to counteract Texas with a map of their own in California that would add more Democrats to basically cancel out the additional Republican seats that are being added in Texas. But you've got other states looking at it, too. And I do think it's fair to say that the energy for that and the political environment that makes that kind of action possible, it wouldn't be happening if that quorum break hadn't played out over the last month.
It's also playing out in front of Texas voters. It's difficult to get the attention of people to understand what is happening in mm-hmm. Texas politics, even when it directly impacts them. Do you think the quorum bust and all of the national attention and keeping this in the news cycle day after day for almost 2 weeks, is that going to have an impact at the polls?
I'm not sure how this is going to play. Previously, it's always been kind of my joke that for Republicans, redistricting is like the movie Fight Club. The first rule is you don't talk about Fight Club. You don't talk about redistricting. But in this cycle, we have seen that Fight Club rule go away for Republicans, and they have been talking nonstop about what they're doing, right? You have seen Governor Abbott say that he's going to add more Republican seats at the behest of President Trump. You saw President Trump himself say that he's entitled to five more seats in Texas. You saw Texas legislators saying that they would do that for President Trump so that he can keep his, quote, America First agenda going around the country. Years past, you would have had Democrats almost seeming as if they're talking to themselves, by talking about how black and brown communities are being, made to be the collateral damage in these redistricting fights. And of course, Democrats are still doing that. But the Republicans are arguing with the Democrats about it now. And the Republican argument is simply to say that this is legal, that we can do this, and we're going to do this on behalf of President Trump, tying themselves directly to a president who's heading into a midterm, to your point, which is generally bad for the incumbent in the White House. It's usually the case that the incumbent president's party does not do well in the midterms. And that's at the root of what we're talking about here. Republicans are building fortification against what they see as potentially a wipeout for them in the midterm elections in 2026. That's why they're shoring up these maps for themselves.
One of the things that President Trump is calling for is a new census. We've never had a mm-hmm. mid-decade census, and he wants to eliminate the counting of people who are in the country without authorization. Mm-hmm. But those people, especially in South Texas, matter a lot in terms of these new maps. If you take those people out of the count for residents, which we use to draw maps, even though they can't vote, they're still part of the representation equation, then these maps don't work.
Nothing could be worse for Texas from a representation standpoint, and I could almost argue nothing could be worse for Texas Republicans than eliminating people who live here from the census. You're talking not just about tens of thousands of people. You're talking about millions of people in Texas. Last estimates were north of 2 million people who are undocumented in Texas. And so it would be awful for us in so many ways and awful for Republicans in so many ways, because right now, under the maps that they have drawn and are being approved by the Texas legislature and awaiting the signature of Governor Abbott, those people are counted in the calculations that were made to come up with those districts. There's nothing good about that for Texas Republicans.
Talking about the midterm slump that any president is going to have, and we have the Big Beautiful Bill, which was Trump's signature bill, and it is tracking through a polling as one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation to come out of Washington, D.C. in decades. Republicans, Chip Roy included, voted for that. Could that weigh down? Could that change the calculus for midterms?
Something that was nakedly political in that bill, as you know, is some of the benefits for certain folks, including some of the Medicaid benefits that were cut. None of that goes into effect until after the elections. That was on purpose. It's on Democrats now, if they want to capitalize on that politically, to make the case to voters that something that hasn't happened yet is coming, and it's because of a vote that was taken in the past, a vote that was taken this year. And so I think that's something that Republicans did that was, folks would maybe say that that's shady, but it was smart politics to do it that way. We'll see if the Democrats have the ability to create a message on that resonates with people.
So what really happened with Representative Nicole Collier? Mm-hmm. Was she locked into the state House floor?
Yes, she was not allowed to leave the Capitol. She was allowed to go back to her office. But what happened was she was presented with the choice that all Texas House Democratic quorum breakers were given, which is you can either stay here in the Texas House and in the Capitol, or you can leave. But if you leave, you have to have a DPS trooper with you at all times, sort of a minder, somebody to be there with you to ensure that you return to the House floor at the next scheduled meeting. And she decided to resist. She said she wasn't going to do that, and so she wasn't going to have a police officer follow her around. She hasn't broken any laws. She didn't do anything that was illegal, and so she didn't agree to that. That requirement was put in place by the Texas House Speaker, Dustin Burrows, and I know this is painful for the Democrats, David. Almost all of those Democrats voted for the guy who did that, who made that decision to tell them they either had to have an officer with them or they had to stay. I'll tell you, I did speak with some Democratic legislators who said that that they felt bad about the fact that they didn't even think about some of them, not all, but some of them said that they didn't even think about the idea that they could have said no, that they could have resisted. They could have said, you know what, I'm not going to sign that piece of paper. She decided not to, and she got a lot of national attention for that.
I wondered why there weren't other Democrats that refused to sign that piece of paper.
And it's an interesting point. There was a news conference earlier this week by some of her colleagues who said, they said it this way. They said they were admitting that they made a mistake to sign that document and agree to have an officer travel with them wherever they were going.
Now, Governor Abbott's talking about punitive sanctions against the breakaway mm-hmm. Democrats. What is he proposing to do?
Well, it's very vague so far. We'll find out what the legislators want to do exactly. There are already punishments for quorum breakers that were put in place after the 2021 quorum break, including a $500 per day fine. And now you see what the Speaker of the House did this time around by requiring police surveillance of legislators who broke quorum. It's something that goes back to the 1800s as a legislative maneuver in Texas that the minority, and it, not necessarily even the minority party, but a minority of members of the House of Representatives and the Senate, by the way, are allowed to halt business at the Capitol or slow down business at the Capitol by breaking quorum. And Texas is unique in this respect. There may be one or two other states that are this way, but it's not the norm across the country. In most states, it's the case that 50+1% of a legislative chamber is all that's needed for a quorum to do business. But in Texas, this was deliberately put into the Constitution that a quorum, the number of people the number of legislators who have to be present to do business, is 2/3 of the House and the Senate. If you think about that, David, that means that the founders of the state, the people who gave us that foundational document, they wanted it to be the case that when there were extreme disagreements between the majority and the minority, that the minority would have that ability to pump the brakes at the Capitol and say, at the very least, we should slow down and think about what we're doing before we just barrel ahead with something.
Scott Braddock is the editor of thequorumreport.com, an online newsletter dedicated to covering Texas politics. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can find us and download us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.